Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for being here tonight at this LSE Law public event on stale crimes. My name is Emmanuel Melissaris, and I'll be the chair of this event. I'm an associate professor of law here at LSE Law. So sometimes crimes are disclosed long after they're alleged to have been committed. And over the past few years, we've had a torrent of such revelations in the UK, or very grave offences which were committed in the distant past. So the question is whether the passage of time has any bearing on those offences, whether our legal arrangements should somehow reflect this passage of time. There is no statute of limitations in England and Wales. Maybe there are some very few exceptions tried at magistrates' level, but nothing very serious. But some jurisdictions do have such statutes of limitations. And in those jurisdictions, offences such as the offences, the sexual offences that have been revealed over the last few years, or the offences that were now committed at Hillsborough, would not be prosecuted. They would have gone too stale to prosecute. So the question is, what's the right thing to do? And what should we take into account when determining what the right thing to do is in cases of crimes which were committed in the distant past? Is it the interests of victims? Is it the interests of suspects? Is it evidentiary issues? Is it the gravity of the offence? Is it the impact that the offence has had on the community? Should we be considering other preferable alternatives to prosecution and punishment? So with us to explore these questions, we have three distinguished guests whom I'm very happy to welcome here at the LSE and whom I will introduce in the order in which they will speak. First, we have Professor Phil Scraton, who is now an emeritus professor, I think, of criminology at Queen's University, Belfast. Phil has published widely on a variety of criminological themes, including women in prisons, childhood, and critical criminology. But one aspect of Phil's work is directly relevant to tonight's question. Phil has conducted in-depth research into the context, circumstances, and aftermath of the Hillsborough disaster. Most of you will be familiar with the Hillsborough disaster. Those of you who aren't, Phil will give an account and background of it. So that work of Phil's includes two reports which were published in 1990 and 1995, numerous academic articles, and the much-acclaimed book Hillsborough, The Truth. Phil's research was instrumental in the then Home Secretary and now Prime Minister establishing the Hillsborough Independent Panel in 2010 to review hundreds of thousands of documents held by over 80 organisations. Phil was a member of that independent panel, and the report of which prompted the Attorney General to quash the findings of the original inquests on the disaster and order new ones. 27 years on, in April 2016, the inquests determined that the 96 people who died at Hillsborough were unlawfully killed. And it was only a couple of weeks ago that files on 23 people and organizations involved in the 1989 disaster were passed to the Crown Prosecution Service, and now we are waiting to see whether the CPS will indeed prosecute. Richard Scorer is head of the abuse team at Slater and Gordon Lawyers in Manchester. He has been described as one of Britain's leading specialists in the field of abuse law. He has acted for victims in many high-profile cases and has particular expertise in cases involving religious organizations. He also represents many young women affected by child exploitation across the country and acts for victims of abuse with learning difficulties. Antje Dubois-Pedain is University Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Law, University of Cambridge, where she is also the Deputy Director of the Centre for Penal Theory and Penal Ethics. Antje has published a large number of books and articles on various aspects of criminal law and criminal law theory, and amongst those are a monograph and a co-edited volume on the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which raised the question, among other questions, that we're trying to explore tonight, whether prosecution and punishment are the best course of action for crimes which were committed in the past. Our speakers will speak for about 20 minutes or so each, so we'll have about an hour of presentations, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers. I should mention that we're being recorded, so bear that in mind, especially when you ask your question. If you don't want to be recorded for posterity, then don't ask your question. You can also tweet. The hashtag is LSE Stale Crimes. So if you prefer to address a question by Twitter, please do so. So without further delay, I'll invite Phil to the desk. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been a bit of a whirl since the inquest verdicts, and I'm not long back from Berlin and Geneva and before that New Zealand and Australia, and I'm beginning to think I'm too old for all of this. But tonight, obviously, I'm going to give a quite different take on Hillsborough to the lectures that I've been giving previously. But I have to give some introduction to the Hillsborough disaster and what happened in the immediate aftermath. So if you bear with me, I will get to the point of the evening towards the end, but I need to give some background to start with. It's 27 years and counting. The way I describe it is that my granddaughter is the same age that her father was when Hillsborough happened. So it is a generation. A whole generation, and I don't think we should ever forget that when we're looking at the history of events such as Hillsborough, that it's intergenerational, and some of the most strong voices now in the Hillsborough campaign were not born at the time of Hillsborough, but they lost their grandparents, and in some cases they lost their aunties and uncles and others, and those who were very young at the time who've taken up the case, they lost their parents. It was a beautiful, warm spring day. It was a football match, a semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, a repeat of the previous year. The eyes of the world were on the game because, in terms of football, these are the events that define the international game. So for people not interested in soccer, I understand. But outside of that, it's an international sport. And at that time, this match, this game being played in a major stadium, was being watched all over the world. The stadium was a neutral venue, Sheffield, which meant that Liverpool fans had to travel from Liverpool across the Pennines, and Nottingham Forest fans had to travel north. They came in coaches, trains, private cars. As they arrived in Sheffield, they were stopped and searched. The fans were, and this is not my phrase, it was the phrase that was used by the police at the time, and it was there embedded in legislation. They were corralled and escorted to the stadium. There was no attempt to filter or steward the crowd as they arrived. I'm skipping what happened outside to go straight to the point. You can see from this slide that as the match begins, right there in the centre, in the standing area in the centre, you have two pens. Pens like cattle pens, where fans were crushed. And to the side, there were people standing on open terraces. How did that happen? And how did that happen when, if you see that blue small hut at the top, that is where the senior officers are watching, with a bank of television screens monitored from outside the stadium and also inside the stadium. In other words, what happened here was that fans were compressed into two standing areas. They were actually six times the legislative agreement of what should be the safe standing area behind that goal. Whereas to the sides, you could sit on the steps. How did that happen? How did it happen that fans could come into a stadium, not knowing the stadium, and end up in this severe crush? The crush is made even more severe because the entry to those two central pens is down what was an illegal 1-in-6 gradient tunnel into the back of already full pens. That had happened because there was a crush outside. The police opened an exit gate and fans walked in, unstewarded. They saw the tunnel directly opposite them. There was no stewarding at the mouth of the tunnel. Nobody closed the gates. Those two pens were already full. And over 2,000 fans walked down into the back of already packed pens. Once they were down, they couldn't get back up because of the gradient. There were immediate systemic failures. At 6 minutes past three, the referee stopped the match. The seriousness of the crush wasn't immediately recognised. There was a delay in evacuating the pens. As you could see, they were real pens. At the front, it was a 14-foot-high railing coming in with spikes and one small gate in each pen, no more than the width of my shoulders. A barrier collapsed because of the pressure in the front of one of the pens, and at that point, they were 20 deep, dying. And they couldn't get out through the actual gate at the front because they were blocking it. The emergency plan wasn't activated. And as a consequence, 96 men, women and children were killed, 400 were seriously injured, thousands traumatised, and many have died prematurely, a number of whom have taken their own lives. The 18th of April was a defining moment because the newspapers moved the actual text from one of pity and concern for what had happened at Hillsborough to blaming the fans. Dead fans robbed by drunk thugs. Vile fans fought us as we tried to help the dying. Police accused drunken fans. Sick spectacle of pilfering from the dying. Liverpool pickpockets pounced on the dead. Yob's sex jibes over a girl's corpse. That was actually Victoria Hicks, Trevor Hicks's daughter. Both of his daughters, and Jenny, his partner, both of their daughters died. Heavy drinking fans besieged the ground. And of course, this was headed by the Sun leading with the truth and repeating these allegations. Kelvin McKenzie, not a stupid man, had actually decided overnight he was going to run the headline, "You Scum." In fact, he was convinced not to do it by the intervention of his political editor. So they ran the headline, "The Truth." This shifted, this day, this Wednesday, shifted the entire agenda in terms of what Hillsborough was about. The legal proceedings that follow, and I have to just go through these very quickly, was a judicial inquiry was held under Lord Justice Taylor, went on to become Lord Chief Justice. He found that the cause was overcrowding, and that the reason was the failure in policing. In other words, that reversed the popular narrative. But look at the date, August 1989, just months after the April disaster. Although he came to that conclusion, and although, as it's been shown, it was the correct conclusion, he never had the opportunity to look at the mass of material that had been gathered around Hillsborough, its cause and its consequences. Criminal and disciplinary investigations were run by the same police force, the West Midlands Police, who I might say at the time had their serious crime squad under suspension for corruption. They ran the criminal and disciplinary investigations. The decision was taken there would be no prosecutions and no disciplinary actions. The inquests, which at the time were the longest inquests in legal history, they ran from 1990 to 91. And to the complete shock of the families and dismay, the partial evidence that was taken throughout those inquests, and I sat through them all, led to an accidental death verdict, the 96 had died by accident. What came after that was civil actions. They were decided without liability behind closed doors, and the South Yorkshire Police, who were the police force directly involved, they paid the highest percentage of damages. A judicial review of inquest verdicts were held between 1992 and 93, and the result of that was that they stated in the High Court that the inquest had been conducted in an exemplary fashion. The judicial scrutiny of new evidence, never been heard of before under Lord Justice Stuart Smith, former MI6 commissioner, was held between 1997 and 98. And then in 1999, the two most senior officers were subjected to a private prosecution which lasted for six weeks. The outcome of that was that the most senior officer, David Duckenfield, it was a hung jury. And his assistant was exonerated. I began researching the disaster with the Hillsborough Project just months after it happened. It was funded by the Liverpool City Council and based in Liverpool. Our research team wrote the first report, Hillsborough and After, the Liverpool Experience, telling the story of the disaster, telling the story of the aftermath and all that the families went through. I then wrote with my team, No Less Rights, the denial of justice and the promotion of myth in the aftermath of the Hillsborough disaster. That looked at the case against the police in particular, but also analysed the full inquests, but also looked at the role the media had played. Jimmy McGovern, as a direct response to that, based on the experiences of three families, wrote the film Hillsborough. That was shown in 57 countries and won a number of awards. While this was all happening, I was watching television one night on my way home from teaching on my master's program. And you know when you're tired and you skip through programs on television, and I suddenly saw this guy with long blonde hair talking about his experiences. And I realized he was a former police officer and he was talking about Hillsborough. It took me 6 months to track him down and gain access. And we went walking on the Yorkshire Moors. After that contact, the third time we met, I was sitting in the hotel, and he went out to his car while we were drinking our tea before I went back to Liverpool. And he came and he put a box file down, and he said, have a look at that. And when I opened the box file, I was astonished. From a senior company, law firms in the north of England, Hammond Soddarts at that time, was a fax, and the fax stated, any of those statements that I am returning that have not been subject to review or alteration are okay to go forward. His wasn't. But the words just hit me between the eyes. A senior partner stating to a senior police officer that he was involved in a process of review and alteration, not my words, his, of police statements. What I discovered was it was a force-wide process. It was known and legitimated by the West Midlands Police investigators, the judicial inquiry, and the coroner. All of those investigations I've just discussed. A judicial scrutiny came about as a direct consequence of this and also at the same time. I wanted to just show how this works, in a way, when a High Court judge running a judicial scrutiny has the capacity to be able to say any wide-ranging inquiries, such as advocated by Professor Scraton, etc., would clearly impose enormous burdens on the police, the emergency services and hospital and medical staff, etc. I am satisfied that Lord Taylor's inquiry team were in no way inhibited or impeded by exclusion of material from the original statements. The allegation made by Professor Scraton of irregularity and malpractice is not substantiated. You can imagine how that went down with my Vice-Chancellor. So, in 1999, I decided to write the first edition of the book, Hillsborough the Truth. I have a few copies with me if people want to buy the latest. What I wanted to do was to tell that story from all that we had been involved with. Contextualising Hillsborough, the control versus safety issue, the endemic failures in duty of care right across all of the organisations. I wanted to reveal the immediate circumstances, the delays in rescue and evacuation, the way the bereaved and survivors had been treated in the immediate aftermath, and I can deal with that in questions. I called that a tragedy out of a disaster. The failure to prosecute, the failure to discipline, and the officers, that is, and the inadequacies of the inquests. I'd argued during the inquests that we should review them at the time of the inquests, and the legal team disagreed with me, went to a family's vote, and I lost that vote by 3. Otherwise, we would have had a judicial review during the inquests. And then, of course, the review and alteration of police statements. When this came out, I thought we had actually made a major breakthrough. The Sunday Mirror serialised it, how the truth was censored, quoting from the changed statements. I thought this is the moment. 10 years on, yes, they've had to wait 10 years. But now we will see a major change, a major shift. It didn't happen. I called 2000 to 2009 the lost decade. And throughout that time, what I was witnessing were families in total and utter distress. As I said before, some of the survivors took their own lives. Others had dreadful breakdowns, early onset of Alzheimer's, a whole range of connected issues to Hillsborough. And I worked with the families throughout that lost decade, but it amounted to nothing. But as you can see from that lower slide, the Liverpool fans, the Liverpool supporters, they never gave up. Truth and justice became their watchwords. In 2009, Andy Burnham stood at the annual memorial service at Anfield in front of 30,000 people. He stood in front of the cop and he stated that he was going to move his government to hold a further investigation and have all of the statements, all of the documents revealed. I was explaining before that I had to inform him, far be it from him being a minister of state, that he didn't have those powers. 30-year rule would mean that we couldn't reveal the documents at that time. But to his credit and to Gordon Brown's credit, they changed the law. And so, in July 2009, we went ahead with a truth recovery proposal. I wrote it on behalf of the families. What that actually adds up to is a right to truth, a right to behave in that way, not just for the truth for families, but in the public interest. I often remind people that any of us could be involved in those kinds of tragedies. To review the conduct and appropriateness of previous inquiries, to identify and challenge the much publicised myths and deceit, to actually develop a research context which would access all the documents and look not only at the circumstances, the long history of Hillsborough, which Taylor hadn't been able to do, right back to Safety at Sports Grounds Act 1979, right the way through to the aftermath and how the families were treated, to establish responsibility and accountability, and to effect that through due process. The Hillsborough Independent Panel was set up with these terms of reference, which I was instrumental in being written. that there would be full public disclosure of all government and publicly held documents and material. The report would detail how disclosed information, and this was a crucial phrase, adds to public understanding of the disaster and aftermath. The public, in that sense, have a right to know and understand. To do that, the research focus would be a content analysis of all disclosed documents involving the context, the circumstances, and the aftermath. I knew at that time this was going to be an enormous task. It's very hard to describe what it feels like to be faced with 2 million documents. 800,000 of those are now online that you can access. The review and analysis of the medical evidence and the pathology was really crucial. But of course, we had no body. We had no body parts. But we would at least look at the evidence and the pathology. The panel was set up. It ran for 2 years. And it came to these conclusions, that there was a clear and present danger. The approach, access, the turnstiles, the terraces, the pens, the evacuation. In all of those situations, a known risk was being run. That the emergency response was unprepared and poorly executed at every level. The emergency plan was never announced. The medical evidence, and this was the hardest thing we had to tell the families. They'd always been told that people who died between 3 and 5 minutes after the crush through traumatic asphyxiation. We had now evidence that 41 could have been saved had there been an intervention within 15 minutes. That was really difficult, and we spent a lot of time as a panel discussing how and whether we should, and of course we should, but how we would disclose that information. Most importantly, we were able to do an analysis which demonstrated that alcohol played no part. And we could confidently say that because the people who died were a perfect cross-section of those who came in to that stadium. I can talk about that in questions. We were able to reveal that all the investigations were deficient, that evidence had been corrupted. And of course, one of the important issues was, who knew? And, of course, the sad thing to reveal in that was right through to Lord Justice Taylor, who became Lord Chief Justice. They all knew. Everybody knew about the corruption of evidence. What we also discovered was that there was criminalisation of the dead. Police record checks were run on every single one of the 96, including the children who died. We were able to show that the coroner's inquiry, in 3 chapters we dedicated to the analysis, to demonstrating that the 315 cut-off on evidence, because he said all had died, who died would have received fatal injuries by that time, that was false. The inquests were flawed. The review and alteration of South Yorkshire police statements became again on the agenda. Now we had access to all of them. But worse than that, the South Yorkshire Ambulance Service statements, they'd all been through a process of review and alteration also. That was a real shock to me. I'd interviewed those people in the immediate aftermath back in 1989. And then, of course, the final chapter of the 400-page report demonstrated that the media had been directly manipulated by the head of the Police Federation, we named him, by the local Tory MP, Irving Patnick, and by 2 senior officers who spread those lies, and they were lies, on that Wednesday, or on the Tuesday, and on the Wednesday they were reported in The Sun. I'd always thought that. Kelvin McKenzie, whatever he is, he's not stupid. He was an experienced editor. He knew he would have to be able to stand over the allegations he was making. So where did they come from? Now we had the evidence. We had the faxes that had been sent by those people I've mentioned. We had records of the meetings that they held with him. That's why he was so confident. The media had been manipulated. The impact of the independent panel report was immediate. The government hadn't seen the report, and nor had any of the parties, and we can discuss that in questions if people want. We refused to allow any of the interested parties to see the full report. We only allowed them to see the sections of the report for factual accuracy checking that were directly referred to them. The Prime Minister got up in the House of Commons that morning after I'd spent an hour and a half presenting the report and its 153 findings to the families in the crypt of Liverpool Cathedral. The Prime Minister came down the line from a packed House of Commons where he announced the apology for the double injustice. The injustice in the first place of Hillsborough and the failure in the courts that followed. By October, the IPCC had announced that it was going to mount its biggest ever investigation, and it's still ongoing, with up to 200 full-time investigators from this period to now. Throughout that, what they are focusing on are the South Yorkshire Police and the West Midlands Police investigators and the alleged cover-up. Operation Resolve, another 200 full-time officers, also been in place since December 2012. Both of these work out of major offices in Warrington in the north of England. That was to focus on criminal culpability of any individual or organisation. And those that are concerned with the police are managed by the IPCC. Those of you who are interested in the technicalities of this can go to the Memorandum of Understanding, where constructive cooperation between the two teams has to recognise the independence remit of each unit. They work on different floors, they pass in the lifts, but they only meet on agreed moments, on agreed topics. The inquest verdicts, after the now longest inquest in legal history again, 2 years, two full years, the interest of justice must be served, said the Lord Chief Justice. He quashed the first inquisitions and said there will be new inquests in each and every case. This would, he said, vindicate the reputations of those who died, and the memory of each victim will now be properly respected. The new inquest ran from 2013 right through 2014, the preliminary hearings, five preliminary hearings, and then the full inquest ran for 2 years. Once again, I was flying backwards and forwards and were not monitoring it from home. The verdict became absolutely mind-boggling, really. The coroner's summing up lasted from February to April. It was the longest summing up I have ever seen, obviously. All of the parties were allowed to see the summing up before it was made, and our kitchen table was laden with thousands of pages because, obviously, the summing up, as it was being brought forward, the summing up was being challenged at every level. I'll skip to the verdict, unlawful killing. It was the only short-form verdict he offered. But now in inquests, we have narratives. There were 25 contributory factors found against the police, mainly the police, the stadium owners, the safety engineers, the local authority, and the ambulance service. And, in answer to question six, the fans were exonerated of all responsibility. It was remarkable precisely because the inquests were being run ahead of the current investigations. The ASPN BBC documentary that some of you might have seen, which tells the story of this from the beginning right the way through, was finally allowed to be released with an updated final 5 minutes on May 2016. The criminal investigation and the Independent Police Complaints Commission investigation is due imminently, has always been the phrase. Mid-2017, we don't know. 27 years and counting. The potential prosecutions. The files have been submitted to the CPS. 15 by resolve, that's the police investigation. They cover gross negligence, manslaughter, perverting the course of justice, misconduct in public officers, and other offences around safety. 8, by the Independent Police Complaints Commission, perverting the course of justice, conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, and misconduct in a public office. There are 170 allegations of police misconduct remaining under review. Of course, it won't have escaped your knowledge or understanding or imagination to know that many of the principals involved in Hillsborough are now dead. Also, we're waiting on, when this is through, the civil actions, which will be a class action. So, justice delayed. Of course, the problem is trying, after all this time, to establish beyond reasonable doubt in a criminal court just what people were responsible for. It has, therefore, a major impact on the charges that can be brought. The passage of time, I know only too well how much evidence has been lost or deliberately destroyed during that period of time. The death of key suspects, the death of key witnesses, the reliability of witness evidence. We know that as soon as a person gets up in the court to discuss his or her memory of what happened, by then it will be 20 years, 8 years earlier, the first question will be, have you read Phil Scraton's book? Did you see the drama documentary? Etc., etc. In other words, the corruptibility and the understandable corruptibility of witness evidence through the passage of time. And of course, in all of this, the problem that we've faced all the way through in terms of media reconstructions and distortions relating to Hillsborough. This leads me to what people wouldn't expect from someone who's worked on this for so long. I'm very concerned about scapegoats and can carriers, that individuals will be seen because they're the last ones standing to be carrying the can, to being scapegoated. That isn't a form of justice that I would want to see. I just want people to be held responsible and accountable for their part in the deaths of the 96. Thank you for listening.
Well, thank you, Phil, for that excellent and very interesting presentation. And thank you, Manolis, for this invitation to come and speak today. As Manolis said before, much of my work involves acting for victims of historic sexual offences. So it won't surprise you that I'm going to argue, and I hopefully argue strongly against the imposition of any sort of cut-off or arbitrary time limit on the prosecution of those offences. I appreciate that this debate about whether we should have time limits in the criminal law goes well beyond the sexual abuse cases, but I'm going to focus on these, partly because that's my practice, my area of specialism, but also because there's no question that particularly since the Jimmy Savile scandal broke in 2012, we have seen a significant increase in the numbers of prosecutions for sexual offences. And it's in relation to those sorts of offences that we most often hear a demand for some sort of statute of limitations to be imposed that would make it impossible to prosecute those offences after a certain period of time. So we have to understand, firstly, why it is that we have a situation where we're having to prosecute so many sexual offences so long after they occurred, and whether imposing a statute of limitations on that is actually a sensible response. And in my view, and in my experience of representing people who have been through this process, I think there are two reasons, really, why we find ourselves in that situation of prosecuting offences so many years later. And the first reason was encapsulated by Lord Justice Sedley, Stephen Sedley, in a court judgment in 2001. It was actually a judgment in a civil case, but it's equally applicable to a criminal case. When he said, and I quote, "It is in the nature of abuse of children that it creates fear and shame, and these in turn produce silence. Silence is one of the most pernicious fruits of abuse. It means that allegations commonly surface, if they surface at all, only many years after the abuse has ceased." That's the reality of child abuse. That's the reality of sexual offences. Victims are very often ashamed to disclose or scared to disclose. And Keir Starmer, who the former Director of Public Prosecutions, now a Labour MP, when he was DPP, and he was going around the country trying to educate the CPS staff on why it was that people would take so long to come forward, would invite members of staff in his audiences to turn to the person next to them and start to try to describe the most recent sexual experience that you've had. I'm not going to ask you to do that today, but obviously an embarrassing thing to have to do with a consensual sexual experience. The point is that the embarrassment involved in doing that is difficult enough to deal with. Think how much more difficult it is if you are the victim of sexual abuse and you have to walk into a police station and talk to a complete stranger about a sexual experience that was degrading, that was humiliating, that may have been violent, that you're ashamed about, and where the abuser will almost certainly have told you, and probably told you many, many times, that nobody will believe you. So that fear and that shame around the taboo of sexual abuse is one reason why these cases take so long to come to court. Silencing is part of what child abuse does, and the worse the abuse, the greater the silencing. And if we have a statute of limitations on the prosecution of this sort of crime, then inevitably you reward the abuser who is best and most effective at silencing the victim. So that's one part of it. But I wouldn't want to give the impression that that is the only reason why cases take so long to come to court. There is another factor, and a significant factor, as we're learning more and more, and this is to do with the way that we as a society and the way particular institutions in society deal with allegations of sexual abuse when they do surface. It's certainly true that a lot of victims of child abuse stay silent for many years, but when we've dug into the backstories of the cases that are coming forward now, what we actually find is that in a remarkable number of these cases, people did come forward and people did try to complain about what was going on, something which is much more common than people appreciate. And people see the headline statistics now about the dramatic increase in the number of prosecutions for sexual abuse, and they think, well, why are all these people coming out of the woodwork now and complaining about something that happened 30 or 40 years ago? Why didn't they complain before? The answer is, in many cases, actually, they did complain before. I'll give you an example of that, a kind of experience that, acting for victims of abuse in religious settings, I hear and see almost every week of my professional life. The other day I was talking to a man who was sexually abused by a Catholic priest in the late 1970s. He was 13 at the time. This was in 1978. Very serious sexual abuse, the worst kind of abuse. Amazingly, when he was 14 in 1979, he summoned up the courage to tell somebody about it, to talk, in fact, to a relative, the one person he trusted. He and the relative went to see the head priest at the local Catholic church, not the priest who had done the abuse, but the head priest. And they told him what was going on. And the head priest, interestingly, didn't seem surprised. And as we know now, he'd probably heard about it before. The head priest said to the boy, and this is a conversation which I've heard described so many times in dealing with abuse cases in the Catholic Church. The head priest said to the boy, "You mustn't tell anybody about this. You mustn't tell the police. You mustn't tell anybody. If you tell the police, your name will be all over the papers." Completely untrue, of course. Sexual abuse victims had, and had at that time, a right to anonymity. "Your name will be all over the papers. Your mum will be ashamed. Your family will be ashamed. You'll shame yourself. You'll shame the church. You mustn't do it. You'll burn in hell if you do it." Those were the words that were used. "In return for your silence, we will move the priest to a different location," which was indeed what happened. As I say, this is the sort of conversation that has happened many thousands of times in the Catholic Church, in this country and in other countries, when abuse victims go to complain. So in 1979, when that conversation happened, that boy didn't go to the police. When he became an adult, he did try to complain. Interestingly, he went to the police in 1997, he went to the police in 2004, he went to the police a third time in 2010, and on each occasion he was told, "We can do nothing about this allegation. We have no evidence. You're the only person who's making this allegation. There's nothing we can do." So he gave up. Remarkably then, in 2015, he was telephoned out of the blue by the police, and they said, "We have other people coming forward to make allegations against this priest. We're going to prosecute Father Murphy," and they did, and in fact Father Murphy in the event pleaded guilty. So that was a prosecution and conviction of a priest for appalling crimes which happened nearly 40 years earlier, a prosecution of a serious crime that would never have been possible if we'd had a statute of limitations, and what's more, a statute of limitations would have rewarded the Catholic Church for silencing that boy in 1979, and indeed rewarded the police for failing to deal with those allegations later on. So that's one example. I'll give you another example, which is a case that's been in the media over the past few days. You may have seen it, and it's yet another case from a religious context, and a remarkable number of these cases of systemic abuse do come from religious settings. Last week, a man called Peter Ball was released from jail after serving time for sex offences. Peter Ball used to be a bishop of the Church of England, a very prominent bishop in the Church of England. This was back in the 1990s. A very well-connected bishop, in fact, in the Church of England. He was a friend of Prince Charles, close friend of Prince Charles, close friend of Margaret Thatcher. And in 2015, he was jailed for sexual offences against young men. And these were offences that were originally committed in the 1980s. What we now know, and what has come to light only now, is that those offences that were prosecuted finally in 2015, when he was prosecuted and sent to jail, those offences could have been prosecuted in 1992. And the reason that they could have been prosecuted in 1992 is that at that time, the Church of England, and probably the then Archbishop of Canterbury, was aware of six other allegations, six serious allegations against Peter Ball. They knew about those allegations in 1992. They had a file in Lambeth Palace containing details of six other men who had come forward and made allegations. They decided quite deliberately not to share that information with the police. So that information about what Ball had done stayed locked in a filing cabinet until 2013, when somebody in the Church of England came upon that file and finally decided to fess up about what had happened. And that led to the prosecution of Ball, and he was convicted in 2015. So again, crimes quite deliberately hidden for over 20 years to protect the reputation of the Church of England. If we'd had a statute of limitation on the prosecution of sexual offences, Peter Ball, a serial sex offender, would have got off scot-free. More than that, the Church of England, as with many institutions of this kind, would have had an incentive, an even stronger incentive, to keep hiding the truth, because they would know that after a certain period of time, it would no longer be possible to prosecute those offences. And they, the institution, as well as the offender, would be off the hook. And I could give you, I'm afraid, countless examples of cases like that where institutions in this country have suppressed the truth about abuse. And if and when hopefully when, the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse finally gets underway and we have those, we have the hearings that we've been waiting for, you will hear many of those details start to emerge, involving a range of different institutions in this country. There are a lot of conspiracy theories involving Westminster politicians, which do the rounds on the internet. I don't subscribe to the wilder conspiracy theories, but it is very clear that there are certainly two cases where senior politicians in this country were protected from prosecution in respect of child abuse by the intervention of powerful people on their behalf. Those particular individuals being Sir Cyril Smith, now dead, a Liberal MP, and the other one, Lord Greville Janner, a Labour MP, also now dead. And there is compelling evidence that both of those individuals were protected and not prosecuted when they should have been. So that is the reality that we deal with in cases of child abuse and sexual assault. The shame of victims, and in some cases the deliberate cover-up of abuse in order to protect the powerful. So that's the reality we deal with. Having said all of that, I have to make it clear that I recognise also that the argument doesn't end there. You can't simply look at this issue by looking at the position and the rights of the victim or the alleged victim. We have to also consider the rights of the accused. I'm a lawyer, like many of you. I believe in the rule of law, and the rule of law means taking account of the rights of the accused as well. And I have no difficulty in saying, and I've said it many times, that you can only prosecute historic sexual offences if you can have a fair trial of the accused. We can only do it where we can achieve fairness of trial. Why I disagree with a statute of limitations in relation to the prosecution of sexual offences is that it assumes, without any justification, that in a particular category of offence, effectively you can never have a fair trial after a certain period of time, after a certain number of years. That is simply not the case. And the cases that I've mentioned earlier, the Peter Ball case and the Catholic priest case, these were both cases where the abuse happened decades ago. But when those cases came to trial, the complainant and the accused were obviously both alive and mentally competent. They were able to testify. But more than that, the individuals who were involved in other capacities, in other respects, in the surrounding circumstances of those cases were clearly alive and able to testify as well. And documents still existed which were relevant to what happened. And interestingly, the Church of England and the Catholic Church both have strong traditions of record keeping and keeping records in storage for a long time. So in many of these historic cases, we have discovered that we can go back and look in the archives, often with some resistance from the church, but when we overcome that resistance, we are able to discover documents that are highly relevant to prosecuting historic sex offences. So it is simply wrong to assume that a fair trial is impossible in this category of case after a certain period of time. It entirely depends on the facts and the evidence. There are historic sex cases, and I freely acknowledge this, where a defendant is going to be genuinely prejudiced by the loss of documents. And an example that has certainly arisen is some of the cases involving allegations against care home staff, staff who have looked after children in the old-style institutional children's homes that were there in the 1980s. And there have been instances there where staff have said, well, I can't have done that, I don't remember that child, and I don't believe that that child was there in that institution at the time. And, of course, if the documents that might prove that issue one way or the other have gone missing, then there is a legitimate argument, or there may be a legitimate argument, it depends on the circumstances, to say that it is difficult or impossible to have a fair trial. But the question of whether you can have a fair trial is a question that has to be answered on the facts of the individual case. It has to be answered on a case-by-case basis. You cannot make generalised decisions about that, consigning a whole category of case in that way. So to summarise where I stand on this, when people advocate a statute of limitations for the prosecution of sexual offences, what I say is give me a society where children are not ashamed to talk about abuse. Give me a society where victims of child abuse are not threatened if they speak up. Give me a society where the police can be relied on to investigate allegations seriously and investigate them properly. Give me a society where organisations, powerful organisations, don't cover up abuse and powerful people don't use their power to prevent prosecutions taking place. Give me all of those things and I will happily concede a statute of limitations for the prosecution of sexual offences. But until we have those things, until we have that perfect world, if we decide to impose a time limit on the prosecution of sexual offences, what we're actually doing is we are making a decision as a society not to punish a large number of these offences, quite probably the majority. We're not making a decision to prosecute those offences sooner. We are making a decision not to prosecute them at all and not to punish the people who do those things. We have to balance that, as I've said, with the defendant's right to a fair trial. And broadly speaking, I think in this jurisdiction we do achieve it. And I believe it's right in principle that we have that balance. But provided we do that, there's no justification, in my view, for a general time bar on these cases. Thank you.
So thank you very much for these, in a sense, stories of concrete examples about which one could talk for a very long time. But what I really want to do is I want to pose the question whether there are principled reasons why one should not prosecute crimes after a certain amount of time has elapsed since their commission. In other words, what are the principled reasons we might have to endorse a system of criminal law that works with prescription, that works with limitation? And when we look at these reasons, we should also think about whether these reasons support a system of prescription which is exceptionless, or whether these reasons merely support a presumption against prescription, a presumption against prosecution which arises after a certain period of time, but which could be overcome in exceptional circumstances, and if so, what these circumstances would have to be like. And I take it as my starting point here that the stale evidence problem is not the one I want to focus on. So the problem that through the passage of time, evidence may have become unreliable or counter evidence may have been lost and alibi evidence may have become impossible because the defendant cannot reconstruct what he was even doing on the day when this sort of thing allegedly occurred. And so that's not my problem, because I think the stale evidence point is one that is properly addressed in the context of exercising prosecutorial discretion. So it cannot support on its own an absolute case for prescription when there is evidence that is reliable. Or when there is even a confession, then we may not think that the prosecution is in any way advantaged by the passage of time or that the defense is in any way disadvantaged by it. So I'm really thinking about whether we should endorse prescription, with or without exceptions, as a principle of limiting the power that we are prepared to exercise over each other through our prosecutorial system. So posed in this way, one can see that there is really a rule of law dimension to this topic. Do we have good reason to limit the authority of the state when it comes to prosecution of crimes simply because a certain amount of time has passed between the commission of the crime and its prosecution? Now, there are obviously disadvantages to such a system. And indeed, some of the disadvantages have been stressed by my previous speaker. We potentially allow offenders to benefit from their own efforts at concealment. We could have cases where somebody just decides to sit out the consequence of their crimes by absenting themselves from the jurisdiction or by going into hiding. We also potentially frustrate victims of crime who only discover that they have become a victim of a crime way after the fact. In certain financial cases, cases of embezzlement of funds, cases of fraud, you may just discover that you have become the victim of an offence after a very long span of time has already passed, and then you might report this kind of crime to the police in another jurisdiction, only to be told, well, mate, it's 10 years before. Sorry, you're out of time. There's nothing we can or will do now. Or, of course, there are the very many cases where the crime as such is discovered contemporaneously, but the suspect is not identified until very much later. And that means we might even have to sit by while the original offenders continue to draw advantages from the spoils of their earlier crimes. So all these are, of course, disadvantages of a system where you say a time out is being reached on the prosecution of crimes after a certain period of time has elapsed. Some also claim that there are certain systemic advantages of a practical kind to having a system of prescription. And the first practical advantage that it is claimed exists is that we allow investigators and prosecutors, we keep them on their toes. They must act speedily in order to proceed with cases. We also focus on our prosecutorial efforts on cases that are still exercising a disturbing effect on public peace here and now. So the consequences of the crime are still actually felt. And we could say that one reason, one systemic advantage of a practical kind is that by staggering our limitation periods according to some notion of how serious we think the underlying crime is, so we have theft prescribed a lot quicker than unlawful act manslaughter, and that again prescribes more quickly than, a more serious offense, perhaps a forcible rape, and that then prescribes still more quickly than something that is another type of homicide offense. If we were going down the route of letting murder prescribe, we would probably let it prescribe only very, very late. So we can use the staggering of limitation periods to also communicate about the perceived seriousness of the type of crime. And in that sense, we are using our limitation periods then to reinforce the public validation of the greater or lesser seriousness of the underlying crimes. But if we just had these these practical advantages in view, then I think they could not support a system of limitations. So what principled reasons are offered in the literature to support a system of limitations? The first argument that one encounters very frequently is the idea of a self-rehabilitation of offenders. So here, the underlying thought is that the need for punishment has fallen away because the offender himself has succeeded in living a crime-free life since his original offense. So say you have a young man, you know, goes out, hangs out with other young men, gets involved in fights outside the pub, and yes, he was the guy who broke that other guy's nose, but he's never found out. And 25 years later, you know, when he is a good family man, very disapproving of the young men who hang out in the pub at night and get into silly fights and then involved in punch-ups, breaking another person's nose, he is eventually identified as the guy who broke this other chap's nose 25 years ago. Should anyone take any action now? Probably the prosecution wouldn't, but one never knows. It might be such an easy case to prove that they are tempted to do it, or they might even have a confession you know, he runs into the guy and apologizes to him, and that guy says, I never knew it was you, but now I can prove it because you apologized to me, so I'm off to the police to get you prosecuted. So if you have that kind of situation, perfect evidential situation, and, you know, conviction in the bag, yet there might be an argument to be made that it's inappropriate to prosecute because this is not a case where we as a community should still think of ourselves as owing the victim that prosecutorial effort. Why? Simply because so much time has elapsed. But, of course, this argument about the self-rehabilitation of offenders, if it merely feeds on the fact that a person has not reoffended, is in itself quite weak. Because we do know from studies of desistance to crime that most offenders eventually desist, that there is a peak period of offending in early adulthood. And what we also know from our studies of desistance is that we cannot even say that those offenders who have gone through the experience of being prosecuted and punished will therefore consequently have an easier time to desist offending than those who've never been caught and just desist for other reasons. And that is because most desistance ultimately is self-motivated, is motivated by a desire to make life work out in a different way for yourself and for people you're close to. And that means it can probably happen just as easily to someone who hasn't been caught into the prosecutorial net and therefore experienced punishment that is perhaps something that does not facilitate desistance in any event. So perhaps we have no reason to give someone credit for a supposed self-rehabilitation that we should assume has taken more effort than as if they had been caught at the time. So it's really just a loss of interest in the original case. But it also raises another problem. So think again about this guy who got involved in this punch-up many years ago, broke this other chap's nose, apologizes to this other chap 25 years later when they by chance meet again, and is thereby identified as the perpetrator of this offense. If you could now, and you could in this country, proceed to charge and convict him of an assault, perhaps give him less punishment because it was so long ago, you still have to ask yourself the question, who I am addressing in this criminal trial? Am I speaking to the 19-year-old, to the aggressive 19-year-old who got involved in an argument and used his fists? Yeah, obviously not. You're now speaking to the 44-year-old family father who has already long endorsed those messages and shares exactly your views about the 19-year-old who was so quick to use his fists. So there is also a sense that your trial becomes very skewed because the purposes, the person you are trying to reach in that context has in a sense disappeared into history. That person is no longer there to be addressed. Another argument that is made in the literature, and in a sense it's the most interesting argument to pursue from a theoretical point of view, is whether we can support a position where we say that the importance of the crime itself diminishes with time. And that's the reason why we no longer think it calls for a public response of disapproval. So the suggestion one finds in the literature is that in some way, at some point, a crime becomes historical. It's historicized through the passage of time. And the way in which I can explain the idea to you is through an example of an interpersonal wrong that's not a crime, at least not in the moment and not in this country. So assume that you find out that last week your partner was unfaithful to you. Chances are you're outraged. You know, this is a really, really serious violation of the trust in the relationship. You are thinking whether you should, you know, split up, leave him. Anyway, this is a big issue. Now assume that you find out that 20 years and a week ago, your partner was unfaithful to you. Well, you might still think that matters. All right. You thought you were in a relationship with a faithful person. You find out, no, 20 years ago, they actually, and a week ago, they were actually unfaithful to you. So this is going to color your perception of your partner. It is going to, you know, make you think about what to do. But chances are that if you walk out, you leave him immediately because you are not going to, you know, live with this fact that this has been done. It has for you the actuality as if it had happened only a week ago. Nobody you know will understand what you're doing. So in some ways, you then look upon this event, this act of unfaithfulness that was 20 years and a week ago, as something that is part of the history of your very long relationship. And it really calls for perhaps an adjustment of your interpretation of that relationship, but it is just part of that. It is in that sense historicized. And there is, I think, a way in which we can look at some crimes in those perspectives. They become historicized. They no longer matter. Even when we find out today, even when the person deliberately covered them up and evaded being caught for them, too much time has passed to call this a relevant event for this day. So that is why I think systems of limitation could be supported, but the historicization point, I think, would only support very long prescription periods, such that the practical effect of having limitations might be very much limited by that. You know, not very many prosecutions would be stopped. What is sometimes seen as concerning, and that is certainly a situation in relation to certain not so serious crimes of a financial nature, is that the prescription period can be so short that it actually undermines the effectiveness of prosecution. And that is certainly a situation that that would then be concerning, because then you're sort of taking away with one hand the promise that you gave with the other that you would intervene in relation to this kind of offense. So it seems to me that the principled case for why there should be prescription should be based on saying we want as a community to have a sense of for how long we typically think that a certain type of crime still matters, and we are not operating with an idea where the significance of an event is frozen in time. You can't do that in any event. Something will happen subsequently, and whatever happens subsequently will contextualize and influence the significance of that event. And that gives me a chance to very briefly comment on the two presentations we have heard here, which I wasn't aware of before, but which I found really fascinating. So in relation to the Hillsborough case, in a sense, one reason why this has grown into such a huge thing is the very fact that after the initial disaster had happened, the victims were hounded and singled out as if they had sort of brought it upon themselves, and false allegations were being publicized about them. In other event, what happened afterwards began to contextualize the original event in a way that made this much, much bigger than it even was, because it was a tragedy that became a crime, in a sense. It was also a crime, but a crime of negligence when it happened. And then there were deliberate ways in which everything was made much, much worse. And the alliances that were formed were all formed against the people who were the original victims in order to suppress the truth of public failures involved in their initial protection from coming out. And so that is the case where sort of the inverse happens from what normally happens. The crime becomes historicized, that, you know, it's sort of people move, eventually overcome this. And it was partly because they were being so mistreated by the authorities. So when you have that kind of situation, then I think there would be a good case for not allowing state agents to benefit from periods of limitations that allow them to benefit from, in a sense, abusing the power they have held at the time when it mattered. And at the same time, I think one has to wonder whether the right format for getting through that kind of story is through a criminal trial. Because it seems to me that what came out in these inquests, also the widely cast net of what was going on in these inquests, had to do very much with the procedural flexibility that the setting of the inquest allowed. And a trial, even a trial of one of the most responsible, might by comparison disappoint. It would certainly not add as much to the public record of knowledge. So it would not expose as much about who had done wrong than if you had merely the trial process to do this through. And that, I think, connects a little bit also to these sex abuse cases. I think there is a systemic problem here, and systems which do have limitations have actually tried to respond to this, perhaps with a non-ideal compromise, usually by saying that the statute of limitation begins to run only when the victim reaches adulthood. That's the compromise. But it also seems to me that the examples you gave were examples where the crime as such was reported by their victims, and then they met a system that wasn't willing to respond. So again, we have, in a sense, a systemic injustice that is overlaying the original injustice and the original crime committed by the individual. And in those cases, I think there could be an argument, and that might be a strong argument, for saying it is it's a case for making an exception, for overriding, you know, a statute of limitations and sort of making it a model where you would allow for prescription to be overcome by prosecutorial discretion if there are special reasons why a prosecution could not have occurred. So that's my contribution to the discussion. I look forward to your questions.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions and answers, which is roughly one-third of what I'd planned originally. But it's my fault for not enforcing the statute of limitations that I had subjected. so there's a couple of roaming microphones, so wait for them to come to you. Okay, oh, good, there's a lot. All right, the gentleman at the back there, then the lady there at the back. Yes, you, sir, with the green jacket. And then the gentleman here and the lady here at the front. So we'll take those five questions. We'll take one from the lecture plus students as well. Yeah. And if I could ask you to identify yourselves and keep it reasonably short. So another sure. statute of limitations.
Please. Sure. My name is Michael. I have just a question, an academic question. I think your name is Richard. You're talking about sexual abuse. My question is directed to you. You use the term quite frequently, silencing or silenced or related terminology akin to that. And I hear that term quite often in an academic setting, but I don't tend to hear it elsewhere. And what I'd like to ask is the following. Exactly what do you mean by that? Can you be precise? Is there a legal terminology or a legal definition, or is that just a term that you are using? And that's the first part of the question, but related to that, which is the second part, you know, and it follows on from that. If person A, who say the accused or the guilty perpetrator, says to the victim, if you tell anyone, you know, you're going to hell or no one will believe you, which I think is the context you're utilizing the term silenced, it seems to me that it's not in itself a coercive situation. It's not, force is not being utilized there, and I'm not sure precisely what is wrong with that per se, apart from it's not very nice.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want me to?
No, we'll group them and we'll okay. answer. So the leader, thank you.
Thank you. Kavita Kolpas, no affiliation. I've got a question that I think spans across all of the cases that you've discussed, and that's around data integrity and the issue that without data integrity, how do you then prevent manipulation, corruption, and alteration of the facts over time, which seems to me to be an exponential problem? That's one question in terms of, you know, what work's being done in order to ensure that in the future, given that we also have social media and many more ways of manipulating the data. The other question or the other point was around the smartness of criminals, and do we actually underestimate the fact that there's a long period of preparation up to a crime being committed before a victim's actually created, and that a victim may not know that they've been a victim of a crime until many years after, for example, in the cases of child abuse, where a child isn't aware that there is such a thing as a crime until they're in adulthood. And how do you build that into, you know, a fixed time period over which you may consider a crime to be a crime, but then not after a certain number of years?
Thank you. We have a microphone here.
Hi there, I'm Deep, I'm an economist. Thank you for your audio talks. It was very interesting and very informative. I've got two slightly related questions, and forgive me if it's extremely simplistic. My first question is, you spoke a lot about anonymity, and I think being anonymous encourages victims to come forward in situations where they otherwise might not. But I've got a related question in terms of the accused. From my understanding of it, they don't get that. And what do you think that is in terms of justice? And do you think that's fair? Should that be changed? In the question of football, because I think there's been cases quite recently, I think Shed Evans comes to my mind, where he was initially accused, found guilty, but later I think it got reversed. So that's a question on how that will affect his life going forward. And my second question is, for those that accuse wrongly, what do you think the sort of protocol would be going forward? Because clearly you could quite affect someone's life in a dramatically negative way if you choose to do so. And there have been cases where people have done that. And those are my two questions.
Okay, thank you. The lady here at the front. Thank
you. I'm a member of the public and I'm American, so I'm going to be personal. I'm an adult survivor of child abuse. And as a 7-year-old back in the early 50s, I watched what was happening to my older sister, and I told the little girl across the street about it, my best friend Jeannie. And that afternoon, her mother came walking across the street holding her hand and said to me, "You don't ever talk about those things." And I never did until I was 28, when it had happened to me then as I got older. It is so vital, because certain kinds of support was available at the time that, you know, in the States, at the drop of a hat. Certain kinds of psychological counseling support that isn't available in this country for people who are coming to terms with these things and realizing that what happened to them really wasn't maybe happening in other families, really wasn't happening, you know, to other, you know, in other schools, or what maybe kind of wasn't normal. And until it seems like a double injustice is being done by a National Health Service that doesn't have things in place, by all of these services not being available to adult survivors, that it isn't just the courts that have to act. The support has to be there.
Thank you. And finally.
Hi, thank you so much for all your speeches. I'm Charmaine. I'm a member of the Lectures Plus project in LSE. So I just have one main question today. So because in our discussions, we felt that a lot of like the main objectives of criminal prosecution might be eroded with time, especially if you're prosecuting stale crimes. So I just want to know, what do you think is the main objective of prosecuting a crime that has already taken place a long time ago? And can these objectives actually be better met using an alternative system rather than prosecution? Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much. Speakers, you have about a minute each, I'm afraid. We'll start with Phil. We'll keep the same order.
I mean, it's difficult for me because a lot of those questions were not directly related to the case that I've been working on today. I mean, I can draw on other of my material to say one of the things I would really want to say is that the other part of my work that I'm best known for is my work on prisons and punishment. And I see every day, in terms of the research I do in prisons, precisely the failures of the penal system and the failures of the penal system writ large. I mean, you know, I see it in, I've worked in prisons in Scotland, here in England, but also now in the north of Ireland. And so I'm a penal abolitionist. I come from the position that there are, if we have a system of punishment, a process of punishment, whatever punishment actually means, we can actually, in many cases, most cases, remove prison from the agenda. So on the one hand, I see myself as an abolitionist, and I see myself as a law reformer in that sense. However, and I think it was instructive in some of the examples that were given about looking for alternatives, and this new, relatively new concept of desistance that people are still trying to get their heads around, and desistance theory, that there are issues here when we connect desistance to the forms of punishment we have now. And to put it in its most simple form, the prisons we have quite often create bigger problems than they resolve. And certainly they don't encourage desistance in any way. And I also agree that desistance has to be self-motivated. It has to come from the inside. But where I begin to part company with that argument, and this does touch on some of the questions that have been asked, where I begin to part company is around the issue of seriousness. It's around the issue of severity, and it's around the issue of the further issue of how over time serious crimes, and I'd be the first person to question our definition of crime in any circumstance, but serious crimes as we understand them, and we've heard an eloquent discussion of crimes that are directly related to sexual abuse, directly related to child sexual abuse, that in that situation, the question of punishment for me is not really relevant. The question, what is really relevant, is to actually have the admission of guilt, to find a process that actually unpacks the truth and reality of what those people have suffered. You know, I understand entirely the broken nose example of a punch-up at a very early age. Somebody smacks somebody, and 20 years later, you know, as a good parent and a good partner, that same man has left his past behind. I understand that. But, of course, you can't mix that into the issue of self-rehabilitation in issues where the prolongation of the context is part of the process. The denial becomes institutionalized. Not only does the denial, whether it's of serious offences such as sexual abuse, not only and also predatory offences in terms of sexual abuse, but the kind of work that I do in a whole range of other topics. I work and live in Northern Ireland. We have families still waiting after 40 years for inquests because the state will not come to court. I work with those families. We worked on Savile, the Savile inquiry in Derry. We've since been working on the cases of, with the same unit of parachute regiment, the cases of Ballymurphy. Now, those cases are severe cases of high-level injustice. To be honest, it's not my concern about what happens to the individual if and when they are found guilty. What concerns me is the process, that we cannot just say, well, the passage of time is such that in such serious cases of systemic abuse, and I'm talking here of institutional abuse, that we can close the book and pretend that those issues are not today as serious as they were then. In actual fact, in some cases, the legacy of those cases, and we use that word a lot in the north of Ireland, the legacy of those cases is even of greater seriousness than the events themselves at the time. So finding a way forward, and of course I would advocate independent panels, wouldn't I? Finding a way forward that is outside of the usual run of public inquiries becomes one way of trying to expose the issue. But once the issue is exposed, we can't deny at that point that because of simply the passage of time, the culpable should not be actually put through the process of criminal prosecution. I'm not concerned about whether people go to jail. I'm not concerned about whether people in that situation are punished in the classical sense. What I'm concerned about is the fact that over time, simply because of the passage of time, what would have applied then does not or could not apply now. We have to decouple the notion of punishment from due process. Due process is about taking people through the court in order to establish their guilt or innocence, and in that, to actually give people redress that their case has been heard. Otherwise, what we do is we fail people who have been through those through that suffering. So it doesn't answer directly the questions, but it tries to draw together the issue of whether we can better meet the survivors of abuse suffering through a process that is outside the law or to the side of the law, or whether the law has to still be implemented. And of course I understand the process of a guard who was in a concentration camp and particularly brutal as a young man, following orders in 1944. I understand the argument that that person is being held as a scapegoat many years down the line. Of course I get that. But in these cases, I don't think there is such a thing as stale, I don't like the word, as stale crimes. There were crimes. They were committed. And we only have due process to hold on to. And most people will only, in ordinary everyday life, will only understand the law as having integrity if the law doesn't have a sell-by date.
Richard, on this point of empowering through giving a voice.
Well, I mean, on the point that was raised at the end, I mean, I agree with most of what Phil has just said. And going back to the point that was raised earlier about certain types of offences having a period of peak offending and then people settle down. And of course, the reality of sexual offending is that is the reality of recidivism, that people often don't stop offending and they carry on offending until they're very old. And that, of course, is another reason why one might want to prosecute to protect future potential victims. I'll just try and do a whistle-stop tour of the questions that were asked. The guy at the back, I think, said about silencing. I'm using it, obviously, not in a legal sense. I'm using it simply in a common sense way to describe what happened. You said, why is it wrong? Well, it arguably is morally wrong for somebody to commit a crime and then tell the victim that they're not going to be believed if they try to report it. And in certain circumstances, it may legally constitute a further offence if it involves threats. But the reason I mentioned it was it's simply part of the reason why people delay for so long in coming forward and making allegations. Similarly, I think the point the lady at the back raised about children not understanding that that what has been done to them constitutes a crime is absolutely right, and that's another reason why the victims of sexual offences often delay for many years before coming forward. And that misunderstanding about whether what has been done to them constitutes a wrong or a crime is something that can persist into adulthood. Guy, down at the front, you raised the point about anonymity and the rights of the defence. In very brief terms, I believe in open justice. I think that there is a case, probably quite a strong case now, for pre-charge anonymity. That, in theory at least, is the position which the police try to adopt in these cases. There is an argument for a statutory reinforcement of pre-charge anonymity. But I do believe in open justice when it comes to these cases, and it is often the reality of sex offending is often that it is only when a person is prosecuted that other victims come forward, because the reality of sex offending is that people often don't say what has happened to them because they think they are the only victim. The Ched Evans case, which I understand why you raise it, my understanding of that, I may be wrong on the facts of that, but my understanding of that is that it was the publicity around the first trial that enabled him to find the witnesses and build the evidence that secured his acquittal at the subsequent trial. So an argument perhaps for open justice. So I hope that deals with the points that I've raised.
Well, I think I probably also don't have a particular point to make about the question, except that I feel quite strongly that when the sorts of events happen where you are up against the system, so you're not just up against relatives who may not want to hear the allegations, but you are up against, in a sense, a much larger thing. You know, you're up against institutions, you're up against a systematic suppression of evidence. Then not only do you find that delay makes things worse, but you also find that what the priority becomes to get an acknowledgement of what has happened out of those whose denials have been facilitated by other people in power. And at the same time, you are increasingly reaching a point where there was a very good question here at the front, actually, about the purposes of the criminal trial, where what we normally seek to achieve with a criminal trial hardly seems to be the reason why we conduct this sort of process through the criminal trial mode. Now, my sense of why we, on an everyday basis, engage in criminal trials is because overall the framework is that we want to decide on which terms we move forward from here with the offender. So that is the purpose of the trial. And in a sense, then, the trial outcome, when it is a conviction and a sentence, sets out those terms. They may be modifiable in the future in certain ways, but that's the deal now, because this is how we think that as a community, as a society, we will respond to what has happened. Now, you were talking mostly about cases where precisely that process has not occurred at the right time. The right time would have been pretty soon after what after the crime took place. And eventually this becomes a systemic problem, because we must then understand that it can, on occasion, undermine the legitimacy of doing it much, much later, although I would say that that isn't inevitably the case. So I would not want, I think it would be misunderstanding to say I wouldn't want to see any late prosecutions of crimes that were covered up 20 or 25 years ago, including in particularly in sexual crimes. But I think we must then have the openness to create procedures that are more appropriate to what is then the real issue. And the real issue then is actually public acknowledgement and admission.
Right, okay, passage of time, good, yes. there's a range of fantastically interesting themes and arguments here. Now, if you want to explore these themes in more detail, more depth, you're very welcome to come to the Lecture Plus seminar on Wednesday at 1, which will be led by me. If you want to sign up for that, especially the students in the audience, please do come to the front, to the Lecture Plus team. It's a student initiative, which is great. We've got lots of other public events coming up. I don't really have time to plug them. It's about new ways of seeing like a state with Fleur Johns. Shami Chakrabarti will be here on the 13th of March. Now, Phil does have some copies of his book for sale. So if you want to purchase the book, do come up to the stage when we finish. The proceeds go towards helping, towards supporting victims' families. They don't stay in Phil's, only temporarily in Phil's pocket. And then they'll be... Right.
Thank you all very much for coming.